Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Breaking and entering, drunk and disorderly, law and order. A former prosecutor and a defence lawyer, not your typical pairing. And the result? Conversations about crime and punishment that are guaranteed to get you thinking.
Welcome to Justice Matters with Joe Crowley and Lizzie Green, a brand new weekly podcast. Our episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify and YouTube. Check out our Instagram for clips at Justice Matters Pod. Enjoy the episode.
Welcome back to Justice Matters. Today we have a one-off special episode with a very special guest to the podcast, Hedley Thomas. For those of you who have listened to earlier episodes, we talked about some of Hedley Thomas's work with the Teacher's Pet podcast and Shandy's Story podcast. And I reached out to him to see if he would be interested in coming on and speaking with us, and he was. So I hope you enjoy this one-off. We did have to do it via Zoom. There may be some minor technical glitches throughout, so apologies for those, but I think you'll enjoy this conversation that we had. We are here with Hedley Thomas, which I have read on the Australian Media Hall of Fame, is one of Queensland's most consistent newsbreakers, a dogged investigative journalist, and one of Australia's most controversial campaigners in the early years of the 21st century. Hedley's received numerous awards, the 2007 Gold Walkley. He has had millions of downloads for his podcast series. We've got The Teacher's Pet, The Teacher's Trial, The Night Driver, Shandy's Story. And so I am very excited to have you here today, Hedley.
Thank you, Liz.
I guess podcasting has become such a massive medium in the last couple of years. And for me, it all started actually in 2014 with a podcast called Serial. I don't know if you are familiar with that one. But that was where...
Yes, I listened to Serial too. And in fact, I think I managed to get through all of Serial while walking on Noosa's National Park over several days and thought it was quite riveting.
Yeah, it was amazing, amazing. So that was a case where the innocence of someone, Adnan Syed, who had been convicted of the murder of his ex-girlfriend, his innocence was being explored, and after a couple of false starts, he was eventually released at age 41 and his conviction was overturned. But then after Serial, the next podcast that really got me was The Teacher's Pet in 2018, which of course was your podcast, and that related to the mystery surrounding the disappearance of a young wife, Lynette Dawson, back in 1982. And again, there were legal consequences as a result of that podcast, being that her husband was eventually tried and convicted of her murder some 40 odd years later. So that's where my love of podcasts really came about. What was it for you?
Yeah, well, I think that Serial was certainly a strong driver for me in deciding to get into podcasting. And as I said, I did listen to it, although I didn't reach the conclusion that you've reached. And I still am of the view that Adnan Syed is guilty of Haemin Lee's murder. He's been very fortunate, I think, that the podcast shone a bright light on the case. And in all prosecutions, there are going to be issues that, weren't run perfectly or 100% right. But, and there'll always be question marks over some of the evidence. But my view, having sort of revisited it recently and for my own curiosity, is that he's as guilty as sin. And that that very controversial decision recently, not to exonerate him, it's actually a bit more nuanced than that, will end up being revisited because the evidence, although parts of it were circumstantial, was strong and overwhelming. And I think in this case, you've seen a podcast in Serial, whether deliberately or not, free a guilty murderer.
Wow. Okay. That is not the perspective I expected from you, but very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we'll watch that space. So I guess having, the opportunity to talk to you, we have in our podcast talked about the role that the media plays in the context of the criminal justice system and the influence that it can have, both positive and negative. And I guess broadly, I would love to know from you, A, why do you think the media reports on crime? And what do you see as the positives and negatives of that?
I think that crime reporting has always been a reflection of the powerful interest, the demand of an audience in information about crime. And it might be local crime that affects communities in which we live. It might be very violent crime that's far away that fires our imaginations and makes us think about our own safety or vulnerability. And I think this has always been such a powerful part of journalism, having true crime reported accurately, quickly by journalists in whatever medium they chose. And we're going back, more than 100 years. Of course, true crime and fictional crime have also fired up many authors. And, Agatha Christie has made such an incredible name for herself, and so many, wonderful books that came out of her imagination in relation to crime. So in terms of true crime podcasting, we're not reinventing the wheel. We haven't rediscovered something that was being overlooked. I feel like what I'm doing with podcasts in the true crime space is simply a different platform, being the podcast, and using that to dive so much more deeply and forensically into an unsolved case in a way that I might have done once, pre-podcasts with a book. But the reality is, a podcast series, because of the words that you narrate and the number of witnesses who interviewed in your episodes, will end up being even bigger than a book. A book might be 80,000 words, whereas if I do 20 episodes of an hour each, I'm doing 200,000 words. So that's 2.5 books. And that gives me the scope to do such an exhaustive analysis of a case. And, fortunately, the listenership has appreciated that level of detail.
Yeah, they are amazing in terms of the depth and you know, the scope of what can be included. So, yeah, I think there's definitely only going to be more of the same moving forward, I would hope. I guess the two podcasts that are most interesting to me are the Dawson and the Shandy Blackburn podcasts, because of the legal components that are attached to those. And I guess I wanted to know whether you think there's going to be any further outcomes for the people in those podcasts. So, for example, in the Dawson podcast, we know that Chris Dawson has been convicted of two different sets of offending in relation to your podcast investigations, you know, which led to the police investigations. But what about his brother, Paul? Do you think there'll be any charges for him? Do you think that we will see any consequences flow from the police investigation into the sex culture with students at the time that Paul and Chris were teaching?
The fact is that Paul Dawson has been accused in police statements and in sworn evidence from former schoolgirls of being himself involved directly in alleged underage sex offences with those schoolgirls. Now, the difference, though, is that one of those schoolgirls would need, or former schoolgirls would need, to go to the police and say, I'm not just making the accusation in someone else's case and swearing a statement and giving evidence for that other person. I now want to be an accuser and bring a complaint and have him charged over what I say is the offence he committed against me. He has, interestingly, in a police interview, acknowledged that he did have sexual relations with one of these women, but he said it was some months after she had left high school. So he said that she was of an age then where he wouldn't have been legally liable. But to date, those former students haven't wanted to become an accuser in the formal complainant sense. And I've become aware of a number of reasons why they don't want to do that. And I know that some of them have also, you know, garnered a lot of maybe satisfaction's the wrong word, but they've gained something from knowing that Chris Dawson has been convicted. Paul Dawson has been accused. He's been exposed in the podcast and in my book, The Teacher's Pet, for you know, what he's alleged to have done. Again, we have to add that he denies that wrongdoing. And so if there has been any justice for those women, it's the public opprobrium and the public exposure of these alleged activities.
And I think that's so understandable. I mean, I think it's really difficult for someone who is the victim of a sexual offence today to come forward and be a complainant because the process is so difficult. So, you know, I can understand that position.
Yeah.
What about for Shandy? So we've had the explosive, you know, revelations about the DNA lab and the reshuffle there, but currently still no justice for her murder. Have you got any thoughts on the likelihood that John Peros will ever be retried? Do you have faith in the new DNA lab as it's reconstituted?
Or whether someone else, someone other than John Peros, might be retried. Yeah, I mean, there's a third alternative. John Peros, who was Shandy's former boyfriend, has again emphatically denied that he was guilty of any wrongdoing. He was acquitted by a jury over Shandy's murder, but then found by the coroner to have committed this killing with a knife. and very savagely murdered Shandy, according to the coroner. So where things currently are is they're back with the coroner, who is seeking to have all of the samples that were previously screwed up by the DNA laboratory during their original testing process, as well as a lot of samples that weren't screwed up or weren't even admitted to the laboratory at the time, made available for retesting with a different process. And as I understand it, and I need to you know, clarify that I'm not part of this process at all. I had an update on it for a little while. It's obviously very sensitive, but there's a lot of very careful analysis by senior scientists that needs to be conducted on the proposed testing methodology before they even start looking at what's left of the old samples. The risk is that if they just go and apply the same testing process that they've always applied, they could end up losing or not finding something that, you know, is probative that could be there. And the reason is these samples have been affected by the original process. So there has to be a lot of care taken. Getting that new methodology is, finding that new methodology really takes time, because they have to actually trial it, test it on other unrelated samples to work out whether it would help, hurt, hinder the process. They have to go through a really exacting trialing of it before they actually get down into the nitty-gritty of testing the actual evidence from Shandy's case. And so I think the long answer is we're going to see a new testing process, but we haven't yet begun that because they're still working out the best way to test it. At the end of that process, I would be hopeful that somebody would be identified as Shandy's potential killer.
It is a slow process. I mean, having heard that about the testing process taking time, and we know not for Shandy because her charge relates to a murder charge, but for other potential cases that will, you know, be recognised as affected by the DNA lab, we have to wait for the law to change, for the double jeopardy rules to be amended so that they can be retried. So it is going to be a lengthy process, I know. Yes.
Yeah. The good news, though, is that many thousands of crime scene samples from cases back to about 2007 are being retested because the failings that were identified in the process that, you know, we had been taking is professional. So that's all on foot. And of course, God, there will be a much more professional process because this lab was found to be scientifically corrupt. I mean, it's hard to get your head around how bad that was and how the group. It's hard to fathom how the criminal justice system for some 14, 15 years completely failed to actually appreciate that this really fundamental pillar of the system was severely broken, was not working. So judges, defense lawyers, prosecutors, all of the people involved in this system, defendants, they have been oblivious to this terrible disaster that's been unfolding for a long time. Some of them were suspicious that things weren't right. And I think what it goes to show is that some of the smartest people in the room sometimes, as in, you know, the case of the DNA laboratory, have no idea. And it takes journalism and a really brave scientist like Dr. Kirsty Wright to come along and point it out. And when people sometimes say to me, well, you know, podcasts, I mean, sometimes they're a bit of a irritant in the criminal justice system. I say, well, you guys don't get it. You don't sometimes appreciate. You can't see the wood for the trees. You're not as smart as you think you are. Two mavericks from outside the system come along and point these things out, and then we run a commission of inquiry. Not we, but the government runs a commission of inquiry. Finally, they agree to that inquiry, and it goes further and demonstrates how scientifically corrupt the laboratory has been, to the point of ousting the leaders of the lab, sacking them. It's a very powerful change agent, the podcast, and it has a lot of potential to make a really positive difference, not just to the lives of the victims and their families, but also to systems that entrench incompetence.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, look, I was literally like a waiting for each new episode, and my poor students must have just been cursing me because I would give them the updates, and as it was all unfolding, it was unbelievable, like in the true sense of that word. But I guess you touched on a little bit there what I was going to ask you about the difficulties in seeking justice from outside the justice system. And I guess I'm thinking particularly about attitudes of police. And I know that with the Chris Dawson investigation, there was, a distancing between Detective Poole, for example, and the podcast. Then we've got like the defamation charges as a result of the Shandy Blackburn. And then for me, particularly, who I read a lot of cases, when I read Justice Fullerton's judgment in relation to the stay application for Chris Dawson's trial and her commentary on your work, I just think it must be so hard to keep going in the face of such opposition.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
It sometimes makes you sort of, pause and think, God, how could so many people involved in a system that has made such a hash of things make criticisms of an outsider whose intentions are good and who's producing new evidence? You just think, well, I need to be a bit thick-skinned, and just put it to one side. So that's how I try to manage it. I have very good friends and contacts, lawyers and former judges, and they give me very strong endorsement for what I do. And I think some of the system's responses to the podcast are quite puerile, unprofessional, and again, not helpful, just failing to appreciate that the criminal justice system doesn't always get it right and shouldn't resent or resist the interests of people from outside who are trying to act with integrity and professionalism to raise things and cases that evolved and should have been, cases that should have been computed but never were, cases where there should have been DNA evidence but there wasn't. Those who are part of that system and resent the interests of and the intrusion, as they probably see it, of journalists, I say, get used to it, suck it up.
The other thing I wondered, which you might not be able to share too much, but I guess I wondered, how do you choose your cases? And do people contact you asking you to take on their cases? And do you have more of a preference to try and bring justice to victims rather than looking at potentially people who've been convicted maybe wrongly?
Yeah, so there's three really interesting points in that question, Liz, and I'll deal with one of the most important first. I am much more interested, in fact, probably overwhelmingly interested, in trying to bring justice to a family which has had no justice, that is, where there is an unsolved murder and nobody has been found guilty, as opposed to a case where somebody who has been imprisoned says, I was wrongfully convicted and I'm innocent. That's just a personal preference of mine, approach to journalism and to true crime investigation. So I think the jails are absolutely full of people who, if they were taken at their word, would be released because they're all innocent. Right? every single one. I'm innocent. So you go down a rabbit hole. Now, you know, if there's an amazing case, and, you know, I know your colleague Joe has been involved in at least one involving Graham Stafford, that, you know, really grabbed my attention and interest, then, you know, of course I would look at that. But my first and strong instinct is to deal with the unsolved involving people who have never been convicted. In relation to how I hear about cases, I receive many dozens of emails a month from people, from family members and friends of victims, and Facebook Messenger. They find my website. They find my email address just Googling, I guess, and they contact me with their information and their suggestions and their request that I look into their case or their sister's case, their mother's, father's, brother's case. It's really, really difficult because, you know, the reality is I can probably only do one a year, given that they can take 6-7 months of investigation and then production and follow and so on. So most of them I'm reading and thinking about, and I'll write back and just explain why, you know, I'm going to keep it on file. It's going to be carefully held, but at the moment, you know, I don't have the capacity to do any of it. However, you know, I might be able to at some later point. Sometimes I'll suggest that they talk to a colleague, even in the media outlet. Know that these cases that they bring to me simply can never be solved. I mean, for example, a 50-year-old case with no witnesses. Sorry, I don't believe this case can be solved by anyone or any police force, because most of the people involved than this will be dead or possibly alive but having lost their marbles, and it's just one that sadly will fall through the cracks. And And that's, you asked what, how do I sort of work out what, which ones I want to look at? I find that, I use the old tummy compass, gut instinct about what grabs me. What I find interesting when I read is if I'm feeling that the case is connecting with me and the people and the circumstances are compelling, and also if I feel that there's a possibility of it being solved, I'm really interested. So those are really powerful criteria. Does it grab me as a case? That's the first one. Because you've got to put so much effort into these. They end up taking over most of your life for quite a while. So you really, really got to be prepared for a big commitment. It's hard to make a big commitment to a case that you're not feeling greatly attached to. Be a bit like that with some of your students. If they get a boring assignment, they're not going to they really enjoy doing. They're going to really, smash it. So it's the same in journalism, I find. An unsolved case that might be solved is the other big factor. But the third factor is how much evidence in document form is available. And I'm talking about, for example, transcripts of, say, an inquest or a committal proceeding that might have been abandoned with file, police interviews with suspects, anything that, will give me a bit of a load.
So, have there been cases you've started but then had to abandon?
No. I've each one that I've started, I've pushed on with, except for actually there is one exception before I started the teacher's pet, but it was quite different. No, I don't think so. There was one that I was interested in, but it wasn't a murder. It was a different kind of case involving a podcast, but it was one that I realized that I wouldn't be able to continue with because of the lack of cooperation of a key witness. About the Lindy Jane, fascinating, and what a great example of a failure of the criminal justice system in that case. I mean, the failure of forensics and the opprobrium that was directed at Lindy Chamberlain, the judging of her because she didn't cry, and the strange church, or the church that many people found strange at the time. I don't know how strange it really was. I think it's probably considered almost mainstream now. Was it Seventh Day Adventists or something? Yeah, terrible travesty of justice there. It would be a really interesting podcast series for somebody now, but not for me because that's a case that has been solved. The dingo did it, and so the point I guess I'm making is I don't want to waste my employer's time and money and my time on cases where we know the perpetrator. The perpetrator, has been convicted of a crime, there's no point to it. There has to be an opportunity to solve an unsolved crime and put a guilty person who's evaded justice behind bars.
And so, are you working on anything at the moment?
Yeah, I am. I'm actually doing two things at the moment. I wrote a book in 2006 that was released in early 07 called Sick to Death. And that was a book about Queensland's health system and Dr. Jayant Patel. And that book came out when there were no audiobooks and podcasts, if they had been invented, were not widely known. And I didn't, my book wasn't an ebook, so it just was in printed form. And I'm actually updating parts of that book, but I'm narrating it for a podcast series, and I'll have voice actors for the parts, and for the parts of people like Tony Hoffman, who's the nurse, She will do her own
Wow.
narration. So that's one project. But that's not a true crime investigation because that one's been done and dusted. It's just a bit of a side project. I am working on another unsolved murder currently, another Australian woman who I believe was murdered. And I'm hoping that that investigation will be finalized and released as a podcast series later this year. And hopefully by July. And
Oh,
I can't
exciting.
say what it is just because it's too soon. Yeah.
No, but that's good. Good to know there's something coming. And then maybe one day you could take
Yes.
on the William Tyrrell case. He still gets me, William Tyrrell.
Yeah, very difficult case that. Difficult because apart from William Tyrrell, who can we identify? The parents and the adoptive
Of
parents
course.
are, because of the very strict laws around identification of these people, you can never really properly personalize this case. My view is that podcasts that are powerful and affect change do so because the listenership is going on a journey with the storyteller, with the investigator, and they're part of the story and they think about it deeply. And to get into that position, the listeners are really needing to know who all of the key participants in the story are. And listeners, as they're listening, they'll be on their smartphones, like Googling people, say, "Oh, I wonder what that person looks like or what he did previously." And they'll be doing their own little side research. But in the case of William Tyrrell, regrettably, it's a bit of a black hole in people. They can't do that. And I think that the ability to solve cases through podcast or make a difference really depends on there being significant listenership participation.
Yeah, no, I hadn't thought of that. Well, I'll look forward to your new one in any case.
Thanks, Liz.
But Hedley, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I'm sure our listeners will be thrilled with this special episode. And good luck with your projects.
Yeah, great. And good luck with the teaching. And perhaps we can check in later this year and talk about updates.
Thanks, Hedley.
Thanks for tuning into this episode. You can find links to the cases that we discussed in the description. You can also find a link to Guardian Criminal Law, and a big shout out to them for making this podcast possible.
The majority of criminal cases involve people, normal people, people like you, people like me, who find themselves in an unusual set of circumstances that would not usually occur in their life. My name's Mark Savick, and I'm here to assist you with your criminal matter. I look forward to hearing from you and being of assistance to you.
If you're interested in clips, you can look at them on Instagram and TikTok. Just search for Justice Matters Pod. See you next episode.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.